So there was some big news this week, but the fun part is that the horrors of America and its racist past are always with us. And so this week we are getting more screen time with the second half of the season of HBO's Lovecraft Country.
She goes on a speed dating event at the beginning.
Oh, yes.
And none of the men pick her.
Yeah.
And
like, it gets real.
Like, I slap the table. It's okay to be weird if you're that beautiful. I feel like if you look like that, you could be a serial killer and say, my hobby is killing people. And men would be like, huh, tell me more. That's interesting.
Welcome back to Popcorn Book Club. I'm Dana Schwartz, joined as always by Tian Tran, Jennifer Wright, Karamadankwa, and Melissa Hunter. And this week, we are diving back into Lovecraft Country for some screen time, the second half of the season. So episodes 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Mm-hmm. 10. Oh, yeah. This is not a situation like Brave New World where there are 9 episodes.
Yeah.
A thing that I think about too regularly, honestly.
Guys, it just got canceled. I wonder why.
Oh, I think we did it.
It's because of that 9th episode. If they had stopped at 8, they would have been like, you know what? This show deserves more episodes because they went into that 9th. It's too much.
And The Queen's Gambit, which is excellent on Netflix now, and I really like it.
Oh, it's
based
so
on
good.
A book, so I can pitch it.
Oh.
Is only 7 episodes.
Which was very frustrating.
Yeah. Intriguing. Mm. I don't know if I like that either.
It was too short.
People are getting loose.
I like that more than 9, though.
People are playing
people
fast
are
and loose.
Yeah, what are we, British? Like, no.
Yeah.
British people can do that shit.
Yeah.
They're like, this show has been on for 17 years. It's got 9 episodes, and we love it, but we need...
And it's called Porrington's Worry.
And every now and then we're going to do a Christmas episode that's related to nothing.
I love a Christmas special.
I love it. I love a Christmas special.
The Brits do really good Christmas
I feel like
special.
We really should bring that into American culture of just like Christmas specials.
You don't like specials. A Star Wars Christmas special?
An episode of our favorite characters getting back together just for a Christmas special.
I think that
would
be great.
I don't know. I kind of hate all of the Zoom specials. I feel like a lot of shows have tried
no,
to do that.
Oh, no, those are bad.
Different.
I don't like that at all.
It just makes me sad in like the same way that seeing kids who have really cute like homemade masks make me really sad.
Yeah.
It's nice for a second and then it's a huge bummer.
Like Tanya Harding's ice skating outfits or something.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh. I like British TV shows because it's like the second best example of British socialism. One is healthcare and then it's how every comedian just seems to get 6 episodes on the BBC.
So yep.
They all kind of have one.
It's an $8 budget, and you have to shoot it into your mom's house, but you get it.
I have a dumb question.
You get it.
Do British people have another channel, or is it just BBC?
It's just
BBC. Well, there's BBC.
They have multiple channels.
No, they have BBC, BBC Weather, BBC Night, BBC Day.
One, two, three, four. There are lots of BBCs, but
that's
I don't.
That's pretty much it, yeah.
Yeah.
Do they have BBC other Sport. Channels?
I think it's the same way. I think it's the same way. Like we have CBS, NBC, ABC, and Fox.
But those are different companies. Well, I mean, not as much anymore. But they're all owned by Disney.
They have Channel 4, which is different than BBC 4.
That's true. That one's
good. ITV is different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Good.
All
right.
They have some different. And they also get all of our TV now.
I did lead by saying it was a stupid question.
No, I think if you're British, sound off in our Instagram or Twitter. Let
if
us know how many
British,
channels
please
you get.
Don't come for me. I respect your culture. I just don't understand it.
My biggest British mistranslation is you realize when British people say not bad, they mean not good.
Very bad. Yeah.
They mean bad.
Oh.
Because they'll say, oh, it's not bad. But that doesn't, in America, that means pretty good. But in England, that means bad.
My brain can't compute that right now.
No.
I
already have a headache and that just made it worse.
I have some dates I need to re-examine. I'm joking. If I dated a British person, I'd be married to them.
So, speaking of not bad, depending on the translation, should we talk about Lovecraft Country?
Ooh,
yeah, not bad.
Segue. Not bad, American meaning.
I had ups and downs with it.
Same.
Yeah. I liked some episodes more than others. And my end conclusion was I think I maybe liked the structure of the book better. But I'm curious to know what everyone thinks.
I think it helped me to watch some of these when I had some more distance from the book, because I wasn't constantly trying to remember, oh, did they do that in the book? Is that something they've changed? I really enjoyed the Meet Me in Daegu.
Oh, I love that
yeah,
one.
Yeah, it was a really good episode. And it was one that had nothing to do with the book, and I thought that was really interesting. Yeah.
I think I liked that one too, just for it, because it didn't have anything to do with the book and it like took us to a different time, but the pace of it felt so much more manageable than some of the other episodes where things were happening so quickly. But there's so much to love about this series, and then just some choices that make me just like laugh and laugh and laugh and laugh.
Well, I think in that same regard, I think that was my favorite episode of these five by far. And I think it made me think of, even though that wasn't in the book, like it made me think about what I loved about the book was each story felt like a bottle episode, right? But then they all came together at the end, and that's why it felt so satisfying. And I feel like the times when they are intercutting between all of these wildly different stories with wildly different like tones and stakes, it just felt like, I felt like I couldn't get a handle on it. And that's why I was like, oh, I wish they were all like that episode.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I would like to add, just to call myself out, I did not finish the last two.
Oh, I didn't either. Thank God. Okay good.
I did. Don't worry.
I watched all of them. So, I watched all of them when they aired. Also, I was like,
okay, Karama, you get a gold Karama, star.
You are in charge of explaining how it all came together. In
I yeah, will Karama, remind you all that I should get a silver star because I did not finish
the
book.
You didn't finish the book.
No, but you get a gold star for this episode.
Yeah,
you're like separate. The star baker. Yeah, it's like like British Bake Off, where each episode is separate, and you
were in the bottom two in another episode, but in this one, you came back up. It's a star baker. You won the technical.
Follow up question: God. Is Great British Bake Off on the BBC? Because
no, it's on Channel 4, which is a different network. Wow. It used to be on the BBC, and then when they switched hosts and one of the judges, it moved to Channel 4.
Channel 4 is trading up.
Yeah, Channel 4 is...
Okay.
All right.
Karama, since you are the one who watched this the way it was meant to be watched, do you want to walk through sort of the basic plot of the second half of the season in the most basic terms?
Oh my God, good luck.
Wow.
I mean, good luck.
I
sort of lost.
I could not keep track
of
some of it.
Making me do this feels like a hate crime, but okay. no, I'm kidding. So the sixth episode, which we've just sort of touched on, takes place primarily in Korea during the Korean War. As we all know, Tik is a Korean War vet, and it does follow Jia, who is a woman. I use that term like shadily, because it turns out that she was not fully human. Get into that in a second. But
quick
it
aside,
mostly follows
Jamie,
her.
Jamie Chung is stunning.
So beautiful.
So beautiful.
Okay,
so
everybody good. On this show is beautiful.
Everyone is so everyone
but not
so
like
hot.
Just beautiful in a she's hot way, but beautiful in like watching her think is incredible.
Yeah,
just
she
like
just
has
a. It's almost uncomfortable. Like it looks like someone in an Instagram filter. It's like, how is someone that beautiful?
It does feel like a problem for me in this episode, because she goes on a speed dating event at the beginning.
Oh, yes,
and none of the men pick her.
Yeah,
and
like
I feel
real.
Like I slap the table. It's okay to be weird if you're that beautiful.
Not in 1950s Korea.
Oh my
God. It's not that weird. She just likes Judy Garland movies.
Just, that's true. And she's like, I went to the movie theater.
I feel like contextually.
And they were like, fuck you.
I feel like if you look like that, you could be a serial killer and say, my hobby is killing people. And men would be like, huh, tell me more. That's interesting.
In the final episode, a guy does come over to her in a bar and is like, and she's in a bad mood. And he's like, hey, you look good. And he's like, do you want to have sex with me and you die? And he like walks away. And I'm like, no, he would just say, okay, where do we go?
No, I feel like. He was like shady, like skeezy.
I know he was shady,
but I think he had a slight sense of self-preservation where he was like, oh, I don't fuck with crazy. That's crazy.
I don't think that's true. I think if somebody is that pretty, a lot of people
would have said yes to that.
Headlong also, crazy. Yeah.
Well, also, it turns out a lot of people did.
The realization that she speaks English, that he was like, oh, no, mm-mm. Oh, yeah. I thought she didn't speak English. That would have been great. But she now knows that I'm a fucking idiot.
To transfer back, a lot of men were willing to have sex with her and get murdered. I believe 99, if I counted correctly.
Yes.
So it turns out she is a Kumiho. I think I said that correctly, which is a Korean fox demon, sort of, if you're familiar with like a kitsune, which is in Japanese culture, sort of analogous to that.
A nine-tail, right?
Yeah, nine-tailed fox creature.
Can I also say, to me, the nine tails looked like tarantula legs, which was very scary 100%. To me.
Yes.
Were not tails.
They came out of her eyes.
They made it very scary, and I wished it was cute. I wish the tails were cute.
I thought it was going to be cute. You wanted them to be like little Pokemon tails.
No,
like,
you wanted something more kawaii.
Be like scary, but cute like a fox.
I wanted them to be Pokemon nine tails, fluffy tails.
Yes, I'm thinking of the Pokemon right now. Okay, go on.
And let like those strangle her.
And puffy little tails.
I didn't like the tarantula legs out of her eyes. It really scared me.
No, that I did not expect.
It could be, and I'm not an expert on Korean mythology, so it could be that that's what they look like in traditional Korean mythological like illustrations. That could. That's my guess, because I don't know why anybody would make them that fuzzy. Because they did look like tarantula legs, unless there was like a base mythology that they were basing it on.
But anyway,
so Tick ends up meeting her while she's working as a nurse in a hospital after Tick has an injury, which I think was the first I realized that Tick was injured in the war. And that was not something I was aware of before. And they end up sort of having a fling.
Gonna say all the art that I see, they're like foxtails.
They're
fox cute. So like very fluffy, very cute. Yeah. A lot of them, nine of them, but not like thin, creepy eyeball tarantula tails.
Okay, maybe Misha Green just likes tarantula legs, and she's like,
maybe I think
I'm gonna figure out a way to put these in there.
All of the sex in this show is very scary. It's like penis snake, blood, so much blood, just blood and skin coming off, tarantulas out of your eyeballs. Nobody has. I guess. Atticus and Letitia have sex and nothing terrible happens. Mm-hmm. At least one time.
When?
That's nice. At the house party?
No.
Oh, yeah.
They have
the
nice
one
time.
Against the sink where she bled because it was her first time and she didn't tell him.
Yeah, she was.
Fuck, I forgot. Okay, sex is terrible. All the way terrible on the show.
Don't they have
I
sex?
I forgot about the bleeding.
I feel like they have a nice sex some other time.
Yeah,
no?
I think so.
I'm sure they do. I don't remember if they showed it, though. But anyway, back to plot.
I think they did.
Sixth episode. Takes place in Korea. Jia is a Kumiho, so she takes the souls of men and sees their whole lives flash before her eyes. And we find out that her mother was being beaten by her father or something. There was something going on with the father.
The father was abusing the daughter.
Yeah. That's what it was.
The stepfather, not her biological father. Her stepfather.
Yeah. That's what it was. The stepfather was raping her daughter. And so in order to get him to stop, she like went to some sort of mystic person and was like, hey, can you make this stop? And she was like, sure, be careful what you wish for, and turned her daughter into a Kumiho, which is definitely one of those. Yikes. Maybe the other thing was bad, but this is not what I wanted. But so she has to sleep with 100 men and take their souls before she can then be freed from the Kumiho and become a human being again. And she is supposed to hit number 100 with Tick, and she's really excited to take his soul because of some issues that she had with American soldiers, including Tick, killing one of her friends for being a communist spy. So
killing
she's
her best friend.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Really
her only friend.
The one,
really.
The one person friend. Who was nice to her. Yeah.
And then she, what happened? She was going to, she like, did end up actually liking him, and they were having sex, and she was able to control the tarantula fox leg tails. And then one time they went out of control, and he was like, what the fuck happened? And she was like, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do that. But also she saw his death in the future. She saw the future instead of just the past, which was new for her. And so she was freaked out, and he was freaked out, but he left. They never talked again until he got back to the States and she was like, you went home. We saw that phone call. She's like, you shouldn't have. So that's the sixth episode. You guys want to speak on anything in that?
Yeah. I thought it was really interesting to see an episode where Tick is given a certain amount of power to wield over other people, and he wields it in a really monstrous way. Mm-hmm. He does not hesitate to shoot her best friend. She might not even have been a communist spy.
She was.
But he actually comes up and shoots, like, two nurses that are seemingly not implicated in our storyline. Yep. So, like,
it's a brutal scene.
It just really shows how being in a war, like, forces you to dehumanize the enemy and like the groupthink. I've never been in the military, but I assume that there's sort of like this groupthink of like an us versus them that really forces people to do things that they would never do in any other context.
I think it's a real choice when they have Atticus justify it by saying, I'm just following orders. Yeah. Which I think we have all learned is not how you are supposed to behave, because it makes people become monsters.
Well, bad phrase. Yeah, it was I understand that's what, is done in war. It seemed like a very specific narrative choice to have Tick do that, and it made me think in that moment, oh, I wonder if Tick's gonna die in this show, because it felt like you're seeing on screen that he has like sins that he cannot overcome, and that's usually like a narrative device to be like, maybe you shouldn't live, like that's, I don't know, it just felt like I saw kind of where it was going from there. Because it is like, it is this question of like, you're on this journey and having it come at episode six to see what happened before it, and that he is not this like hero, like that is imperfect or that is perfect in every way, like that he has these sins of the past that are coming back to haunt him. I thought was an interesting choice.
The thing I liked, and I think you alluded to earlier, is that it shared that sensibility with the TV, the book rather, that it was a self-contained story where it applied mythology on a social issue that's really genuinely interesting. Like, I really liked being in that world for a little bit, like seeing the Korean nurses during this war and like getting their perspective and like getting those moments of the dating and the taking care of soldiers. And then mixed with this really interesting mythology element. Like, I think that's sort of the show and the book and the genre at its best, where it's like inserting mythology into a situation that's like already interesting and then using the mythology to heighten it.
There's also this dry, terrible humor to this episode. Yeah. I really love it when they're all watching a Judy Garland movie at the movie theater. And suddenly there are like loud booms outside and American soldiers are rolling through their towns distributing pamphlets saying, do not be alarmed. America is here. As if this is not a very alarming situation to be in.
Mm-hmm. But I love that choice too, and kind of positioning the message of like showing it through like an imperial, like American imperialism. Mm-hmm. I don't think we get to see it that much. Or I haven't seen it that much in a lot of US TV or American TV, of just like, yeah, there is such a complicated history of war and this like, we gotta help save democracy in other countries narrative that like, I think we have all been raised to not question and or think about it from a different perspective. And like, you know, as a Vietnamese American, I've been starting to unpack that a lot. And that particular episode felt very like, ooh, yeah. Like seeing how US military involvement in certain countries is such a complicated thing to see and experience and like try to question. So I really admired that take from them. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. In that vein, I really enjoyed the fact that the episode was like 80% in Korean. And I think that so often in American television, when we have people of other cultures speaking to each other, they are speaking English because there's this like not, I don't want to say revulsion, but there's this aversion. Aversion is the word I'm looking for to subtitles and this sort of feeling like, well, I don't want to have to read subtitles. I just want to understand what they're saying. And I like that they were like, nah, you go read subtitles because they are Korean people in Korea speaking to other Korean people. It does not make sense for them to speak English just to make you comfortable. And this is what their world is like. And also there are nuances there that exist because like Korean as a language has a formal and informal case where English doesn't really do that anymore. We used to have thou and you. And then we were like, in the 17th century, we were like, what if we just got rid of thou? What if we stopped doing that? So we don't have that anymore. But languages like French and Spanish and Korean do have formal and informal. And I think that you lose that because there's like a little scene where they were like, oh, my God, he started using this case on the date. And I'm like, that's too soon. And I was like, oh, he did what, girl? And I felt like I got to take a glimpse into their world. And I was being invited in as opposed to imposing this American perspective on another culture.
Yeah, I love that. Like, it's like we are making this to make this to fully represent. It's not for a specific like American audience. Mm-hmm, like you are seeing it as it should be seen, ideally.
I did hear that the subtitles were very badly translated, though.
Oh, were they?
Yeah, my friend who is not Korean but does speak fluent Korean. I texted him and I was like, tell me about the Korean in that episode. He was like, yeah, it was okay. And there were things that I, as a non-Korean speaker, but like I know like six words in Korean because I'm from Los Angeles. I was like, why does it say umma on the screen instead of mother? Because that's what that means. Yeah, it's that not a name.
That confused me.
And sometimes it did and sometimes it didn't. That was the thing. It was inconsistent within. But, you know, they're doing their best, and I know that they got a Korean co-writer on that, too.
You know, I read an article about, there was the earlier episode where the native woman who was trapped in the museum gets freed and then immediately murdered.
Yeah, that one.
So there was criticism online of like, hey, that's not like a great way to use, you know, a character. And the showrunner apologized and was like, yeah, the goal of that episode was to show that like even marginalized people can then be cruel to like other marginalized people. Like it's a chain and a system. And I didn't think that episode was successful at communicating that message, but I thought that this episode did get that across.
Yes.
In a way that made sense where it's like, yeah.
Well, that's what I think you guys are touching on is like it was all from the Korean woman's perspective, or the Korean woman slash monsters, fox monsters perspective. And I think
tarantula monster.
It is. I feel like that's why I think it was my favorite episode of the whole season is because it felt like a very surprising turn. Like I expected to see Tick's experience in the war, but I didn't expect to see it not from his perspective at all, and that he only comes in and when he does, he immediately kills a woman. Like, I think that's why it was successful, because it doesn't sideline the marginalized group. You know, it makes them, it's her narrative.
Mm-hmm. I also like this episode, and I think I am a good television watcher. Like, I'm a smart person, and I like to stay engaged. I found the next four episodes a little hard to follow and to anchor myself at points because time traveled at different speeds and a lot happened and there's a lot of CGI and a lot of gore that I sort of got like TV overload. And I liked the pacing of this episode because I could wrap my head around it, where it's like once we got back to Chicago and then also back to Artem. Sorry. I was blanking on that. It just like it got hard for me to put like distances and places and times focused in my head in a way that anchored me.
You mean things were Hardem and Artem? Hey.
Okay.
There was a lot. There's like a lot of visceral horror and like images that were just like thrown at your face a lot. Everyone was covered in blood at some point.
Okay, my foxtails are getting all tangled. Let's take a break.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, let's talk about the next seven yeah. to ten. Yeah. Let's talk about those. I guess it's still my job, but
no, I can give the big overview that as I saw it.
Six felt like it needed its own situation because it was so different. But I feel like the next four can be summarized pretty much together in a way.
I mean, I think the big overall plot now is Christina / William, who is Christina, wants to do a spell that will make her immortal. And she needs Tick's blood to do it. And that is just a fact. And she refuses to examine any further. That's just a thing she needs. And she's willing to do it. And they want to... Alliances shift at certain points, but she enlists Ruby to help her in that. They decide... I think the overall goal for our gang is to make a salt circle and to banish... their patriarch, Titus, who's sort of a reoccurring... Mm-hmm. Evil, sort of like Biff in the Back to the Future universe.
So,
like,
no matter Biff.
But you know how, like, whatever time period they're in, there's always a Biff?
Yeah.
that was the vibe I got from Titus, where it's like he's just a reoccurring evil, and they wanted to banish that for good. Did I get the big picture? Yeah. Did I miss?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, you did. I was going to.
And other things.
But details
happen.
Are other things. Yeah. Yeah.
So let's details. Talk about the details that we enjoyed or didn't enjoy or that stuck with us in some way throughout that. For me, I really liked the change. I got the change from Horace to Diana in this second half in a lot of ways. And I really liked the episode where Dee is being followed by. Topsy and Boxy,
very scary.
I think their names are.
Oh,
they're
genuinely scary.
Terrifying. Yeah.
They were very scary.
That episode, I would say 6 and 8, even though I didn't watch the last two, but 8.
Yeah, I really enjoyed 8. I thought making her friend Emmett Till was a really interesting choice.
Yeah.
They set that up in the first half.
Yeah. We called that when they were in the house doing the Ouija board.
It wasn't a calling because like his name was Bobo, which was his nickname. Like they specifically explicitly made that clear that was going to happen. And I was kind of bracing for that.
Yeah.
I really loved in that episode that they did not show his body. And it wasn't because there has been so much body horror, but it was about magic and the people in this world who are fictional. And Emmett Till, as somebody who is a real person who had a real horrible death, they didn't show his body and they showed his death, but they showed it on a white woman instead of on him, which I thought was a fascinating and amazing choice.
Yeah. 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 What did we make of that? Which is Christina paid a lot of money to be able to experience Emmett Till's death.
Well,
what
earlier, Ruby asks her if she feels anything. If like Ruby is understandably devastated by this death. And Christina says, nope, she doesn't feel anything. Does not bother her. It is not what she's thinking about. She can't feel it. And
props for honesty, honestly.
I guess, yeah. But I don't know. Maybe at the end, to me, I thought she was trying to feel it. Like, maybe the only way she could feel that would be if it happened to her personally, which is a thing that I think some very privileged people do experience, that you don't really care about making sure people get healthcare until someone you love is denied healthcare. So I felt like Christina was trying to experience what something that horrible would be like, but she's invulnerable. Like, even when it happens to her, she comes back to life immediately.
Well, she's, and she's like a, I feel like it was a good way to show how she is kind of this unfeeling, like, villain, you know, that has that kind of like a next level, like, sociopath or whatever you want to call that. I know that's often misused or overused. But yeah, this is very stupid. But you know what it made me think of is I once saw this show where men had to get... like had these like nerve things on them.
Was that the Try Guys?
To feel like they're having a baby, like the contractions of labor. No, it was on this very dumb reality show that I watched all of about about a woman who is like The Bachelorette, but she's trying to have a baby, Labor of Love.
Oh, that show! Labor of Love exists.
I forgot about that.
On Fox, yes.
Such a good COVID show. And all the guys on that have to do it, and they're like,
"Whoa,
that's
hard." I was so excited about Labor of Love.
But just like the idea of like putting yourself in that situation in order to have empathy for a person who's having a baby. It's just very funny.
For me as a viewer, though, I felt very, I don't want to say cathartic because I don't wish that on anybody, but it did. Again, I think I said this in the first conversation, or maybe it wasn't when we were talking about Lovecraft Country. It was when we were talking about The Hate U Give. The woman who accused Emmett Till of whistling at her is one, I believe, still alive, at least as of a couple of years ago, was still alive. And two, was never held responsible in any way. Mm-hmm. And for me, visually, that's what that signified, was her facing some sort of consequence and showing a white woman suffering for that.
And that woman lied about it.
She lied. Mm-hmm. She admitted she lied and faced no consequences. Zero. Yeah. Even now, we know that she has lied. She has admitted she lied and nothing has happened to her. She just gets to live out the rest of her miserable life in peace.
I think I liked the use of Christina to sort of stand in for a lot of like white feminism. The idea that like she thinks like because she's excluded from the boys' club of magic that she, you know, is a victim in certain ways and then needs to.
And that's the same as Ruby. Like, yes, we're the same. Yes. Like, we're both like having a hard time. It's like, no, girl.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I found her a very interesting villain, but I didn't quite find the ending. I don't want to skip ahead to the ending. Oh. I didn't find the ending as cathartic as I think it could have been. We're in the book, the way they outsmarted her in like an Ocean's 11 style heist. I
hated the ending of this show.
I liked the last little bit ending with D. We'll get to that.
Yes. Okay.
Someone
hadn't seen the ending.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, okay.
Summarize it.
From our listeners who obviously did not watch the end of it.
I'll just get to the end part real fast. So they're trying to beat Christina at her own game and do the spell before she does the spell. But surprise, Ruby, who has come with Letitia to help, is actually Christina in a ruby
ruby shell skin suit
in a ruby in a ruby shell, because Ruby's in a coma. I think I missed how that happened.
What they said was Christina caught Ruby so trying to steal the potion because there was a spell.
Yeah, they didn't show it. I don't think.
They didn't show it, but they did because we had to believe it was Ruby through the car ride. I love the car ride.
Yeah, the car ride was cute.
She said, it's your fault that your sister is dead, which debatable whether she's dead or not. And she might be in a coma. But she caught Ruby trying to steal the potion
for
their spell because they needed a little bit of Christina and they needed a little bit of Titus.
Yes.
Which
so
was crazy
she's got
that they stole
the Ruby
tart.
So she's got the ruby polyjuice and it's like she's turns back, you know, she's Christina, surprise. And then Christina gets at like or Atticus's guys get Atticus on like a Jesus
crucifix.
Cross.
It's a crucifix.
It's a crucifix. And his arms are like bleeding out. And it's this scene where Christina is like in a white dress and she's, you know, very pale and blonde and is just like doused in blood. And it's
very. She's like Miss Aryan 2020.
Yes.
Or I guess they're in 1950.
It was like if a model, if like a photo shoot were like, we want Carrie vibes, it would be that, you know?
It's like, it's the America's Next Top Model, but they're like just signed a horror movie.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a Halloween special.
And then she, you know, and Letitia's running in her heels.
She slashes like the whole
that part is very
you see skin separate from
it's really
skin. It
intentionally
foul.
Gross.
They really gross that in.
And then to me this is the goofiest part of the whole show is like it's just, there's like a storm of clouds, and Letitia is on her knees saying the spell, and she, and there's like a literal tornado, and then, and they're like, we, I can't get the spell to work unless they're connected. And so then the fox demon,
Gia,
is like, I can do it. And so she gets out her fox tails and connects Tick and Christina, but it's too, it works. It takes away her immortality, but Tick is still dead. And then, and all of these things collect, all of these, like, it's in some kind of like abandoned Coliseum looking place.
They did it. I think it's the meat cellar where Montrose was at in the first.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah, it's that place.
I think it's that same.
It's in Artem somewhere on the grounds of that.
I was almost sure it was they did it in the place. Yeah, it was a lot of things happening.
And then she loses her immortality. And then they all leave and leave Christina under all these like cinder blocks and she can't get out. And then Dee comes up and has a mechanical arm now because she lost her arm in the curse and kills her. Like breaks her,
chokes her,
goes through her neck.
Yeah.
There's like a lot of viscera.
And which I don't love a child.
I didn't love that.
I don't think she's a child anymore. That's the thing. That's the thing that it's sort of like what Star goes through in The Hate You Give, where you don't get to be a kid anymore once you watch one of your friends die horribly. Yeah.
I know, but I didn't. It was the mechanical arm to have that to just do felt that. Very.
I didn't want her to have to deal with that.
I listened to the HBO Lovecraft Country podcast.
Okay.
Really working for that gold star.
Yeah.
I only listened to the final episode because I didn't want to get too influenced by all the other episodes and I wanted to like unpack it myself. But I did listen to that final episode because there was a lot happening in that episode. I was like, I want to hear from these clowns. These clowns being Misha Green and Journey Smollett, who are wonderful clowns in the best sense. And they talk about how it's the youth pushing forward. And that's what that was supposed to sort of symbolize. It's kind of like how TikTok might save democracy because young people are spreading information so quickly and through ways that are entertaining. And I think that she's been radicalized. She's the young person and she's the one who realizes that they are only going to advance by spilling blood other than their own. And she even says they never learn. And then that's her saying, like, we can't keep doing what we've always done. We can't just take magic away from them because she's under these rocks. She can get out. She's like, no season two for you, Christina.
Oh, yeah. That was another important piece is that the spell worked and that, like, it reversed her immortality, but it also took away not only her magic, but magic from all white people.
All white people.
So then like, it's ours now. So
Letitia and Tick survives, right?
No, Tick dies.
No, Tick's done.
What?
Yeah, I was not... happy with that choice.
If you saw it, you would be like, even if they got there in time, those are deep cuts.
For the story, I'm sure he has to sacrifice himself to save everybody else.
He's on a Jesus cross.
Is he on a Jesus cross as it happens?
I felt like this is why it didn't feel like
he died to sacrifice people. It felt like he just died.
I think this was my issue with the show and why I go back to episode 6 being, and I think 8 equally was like similarly contained. It just felt like there were so many ideas and it was so ambitious for a show. Because when I read the book, I'm like, oh, this is going to be an ambitious show. And then somehow they added like 1,000 more ideas to it. And it's bigger than the book. Hippolyta, which I don't love pronouncing it like that, but that's how they pronounce it on the show. Hippolyta's journey. I was like, that was the goofiest bit to me.
That episode
I was just
was
like,
really wild.
Oh, I loved seeing her get to dance with Josephine Baker.
I thought that was really sweet.
I think it was fun, but I don't know if it meshed.
I thought
with
it
the rest of the
I don't know what happened.
I just, I here's my problem with it is like, it wasn't any of those shows. It wasn't a Gladiator show. It wasn't like a Showgirls show. Mm-hmm. So the way it was written and directed, in my opinion, it made it seem like kind of cheap, because it's not directors who are directing that kind of show. They're doing a horror show. So it just felt like I was watching like someone trying to do Game of Thrones who only directs like thrillers. You know what I mean? It just felt like, and then the space stuff, I get that. I'm not saying that other people aren't allowed to like it. I just, I did not like it.
I think in terms of production and in terms of like fitting into the larger narrative of the show, not great on that one. And in terms of like at the end, me knowing what the fuck was happening, not super great either. Cause I was like, wait, is she in space time forever? Yeah. Unclear.
Yeah.
But
yeah. And her hair's blue now. That's important.
Yes. In 1950, I'm like, this feels radical in 1950 something. To have like a blue haired woman, like just like she got what's that box dye that's got like edgy people on it? It's like edgy. You know the thing. I'll look it up. I'll find it. Well, but it's like riot something. But anyway, my point is,
you had a point. Yeah.
I did have a point, not just trying to remember the name of the box dye. For me, I thought that it was really moving to be able to see a Black woman name herself as something and then just get to do it and just get to experiment and try. And particularly for Hippolyta, because if you look at the beginning of the show, all she wants to do is go on a guide trip with her husband or just go on a guide trip. Mm-hmm. And then she is able to do that, but only through the death of her husband. So it's, she's taking on the mantle of this business so that they can stay alive. And in this episode, Hippolyta, when she's asked, like, what do you want to do? She's like, I don't fucking know. I want to dance on stage with Josephine Baker. And then she gets to do it. And she just gets to be like, wait, this is my life now. I just get to say something and then do it. And I thought that was something beautiful to get to watch. And I thought that it was a very visually stunning episode. But yeah, I didn't know what the fuck was going on at the end of it. I was like, cool. This was so much fun. And I enjoyed that. And I heard that it was supposed to be a love letter to Black women. And I was like, I felt that. But it's kind of like, it felt like a little bit like a drunken love letter. I was like, I feel the love, but I don't know exactly what to do tomorrow.
Yeah, I in that framing, I like it much better. I think what I wanted to point out with it is that, like, the story in the book is so beautiful and contained. And it was one of my favorite stories in the book. And I felt like, that's what I felt like the show kept doing, was like, let's take this box that we put all these stories in and let's open them. And then it kind of goes everywhere. And then it just becomes a lot harder to follow the thread, which is fun. But then it also kind of makes my head spin a little bit.
It's like one of those jar of snake things that you get for April Fool's Day. And like one snake would have been enough. We would have been like, ooh. Okay, but it was like all the snakes.
That was my big critique, because so often when there's an adaptation, you're like, oh, okay, you understand that like more nuance can just be in text than can be on screen, just like that's by the forms. But they, in the show, made the universe so big and had so many ideas that it, as Melissa was saying, like it got a little confusing. Like I had fun with that episode, like in isolation. Like, I was like, oh, that Josephine Baker was really fun. And I almost wish then just, like, make that the episode.
Yeah.
You know, then do it so that somehow she gets to stay with Josephine Baker longer. I don't know. I had fun. But I then was intimidated coming back to Chicago being like, I don't know what characters are where and what the stakes are.
But the thing that I always think about when I think about Hippolyta is that she wanted to name Pluto. Like she was someone who, when she was young, had such big ideas and such big dreams, and she kind of had to crush them down as she got older and she got married and she had children. And it's just so beautiful to see her get to have those big, enormous, crazy dreams again, where she gets to fight Confederate soldiers and dance with Josephine Baker. And
that was weird that they were Confederate soldiers, but also in some dusty village, but they were gladiators and like
it's
a
her
Roman
fantasy.
Empire.
She's yeah, allowed to have her up, fantasy. Right?
It was yeah. not bad, yeah. Weird, but when they were Confederate soldiers, I was like, hold up.
I think what you're all saying, I loved that. I loved getting to see Hippolyta like have agency, find herself, call out, name the things that she wanted to name. I loved the level of quality in the detail with the Josephine Baker. As you moved to the other ones, it felt like it lost that like even set quality or like mm-hmm. just general storyline quality. Like mm-hmm. the world of Josephine Baker was, if that world felt so full, like it felt full in line with the rest of the show. It felt like it could sit alongside like Chicago 1950s. Like it just tonally shifted so much that I was like, this almost is like, oh, like you've all said, it just doesn't match. I enjoyed it. I loved it, mm-hmm. but it just like, if we are going to do that, like make sure it matches. Also, she turns into a computer. That really confused, or like she turns into, what does she have?
She has some sort of chip in her body. Unclear. Look, that episode wasn't for us. That episode was literally for Hippolyta and only for Hippolyta. And I'm glad she got it.
That actress is amazing.
Yeah.
That was fun. I thought another sort of question I had, I loved the curse on Di because I thought that they captured like how viscerally scary the police officers were. Yeah. And then that was horrific when she was being chased by the creepiest racist imagery I've ever seen in my entire mm-hmm. life. Mm-hmm. I wish that the cops, what I liked about the book conclusion was the mundane bureaucracy of racism, like how these like, quote, like masters of the universe racist people were in a convention center and we conquered all of them and the cops were in that. And it was just like how shitty and mundane racist infrastructure is. So those cops didn't quite get their comeuppance. And I think centering the finale just on Christina made mm-hmm. it seem like here's just one evil woman and not like this whole system is incredibly evil and deep in our systemic infrastructure.
I mean, they did take magic away from white people. Like all
we
of
didn't
them.
See that.
That's true. The cops did get comeuppance a little bit, but from Christina.
Yeah.
Because she turned the healing against them.
Oh,
the restorative power against them. So they did get a little bit, but not in the way of the book. But something I really liked structurally about the episode where Dee is getting chased by these terrifying girls from the cover of Uncle Tom's Cabin mm-hmm. is that it was just one piece of scary imagery as opposed to a bunch mm-hmm. of different ones. Mm-hmm. So it was the same thing following her. And I think visually that works so much better than in the book having all of these different things where it's like, oh, thematically they are all related, but visually having the same specter come after her again and turning dancing scary was oof.
That
also, one of
quality...
those dancers was in the WAP music video.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I was the scariest for me was when she did the over the back.
Yes.
Look.
Oh yeah.
Scary
top,
back flexibility
at the top of the L.
The L. Oh my Ooh. God, that visual is just horrifying to
me. Yeah, because that's like those details to me about this show are what are so impressive when they like really nail it, like. The fact, like you said, Karama, that they move in such a specific way, like that could have just been regular spooky chasing, but it was like the choreography of like the bones cracking and like this just, and the sort of like heel click too, that is
And the music.
And the music.
Like, yeah. Cheery, scary music about knocking at the door. I'm like, no, don't knock at my door. Go away.
I think that's what I really admire about the show and where mm-hmm. some of my, at the same time, issues come with it is I feel like it is so ambitious and they try mm-hmm. to really go for it. And sometimes it came off as like kind of silly or like a little not great, like the baby on the baby ghost, the baby on the baby head ghost is like, oh, you thought that would be really scary, but it's kind of silly versus this. Like, mm-hmm. again, it's like this full commitment to like, let's just go for it and then see Like, I thought those, like, underground monsters were really goofy.
So goofy.
But then some of it is terrifying. And so I feel like it's, you know, it's they were trying everything and to varying degrees of success.
I did like that Tick got his own underground monster and that his was black.
I did like that too, but I also laughed when whatever moment made the Shoggoth's eyes like fire blood, like shoot blood at them made me laugh so hard. I was like, that's a choice.
I am so fascinated. I really want to find out what the budget was for the show because it feels like almost Game of Thrones level budget. Yeah. Like in terms
it had to be huge.
It's a period piece that like goes into outer space and has like ground monsters and baby football players and like just so many elements that feels like this is a wildly expensive show.
One thing that I thought was important that is a thing in our culture that's not always discussed is like how racist the origin of Eenie, Meenie, Minie, Moe is.
Mm. Oh, yeah, it's very racist.
So much shit is racist. The ice cream truck song is racist.
What's the ice cream truck song?
The one that's like the song that plays when ice cream trucks go by.
Oh,
it's Nigger Wanna Watermelon Ha Ha Ha.
Oh,
what? I thought it was Yankee Doodle.
No, there are like a couple of different ones, but there's like one that is that plays frequently, and it's called Nigger Wanna Watermelon Ha Ha Ha. I love that the ha 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 is included in the title. That just really makes it.
It's very like Nelson from The Simpsons.
There's like an NPR article on it that I'll send you all. That's very illuminating.
Yeah.
Ice cream is still okay, though. You guys can still eat ice cream.
Speaking of horrific racism, should we talk about the time travel episode to Tulsa? I think that's the one we skipped over.
Yeah. I really enjoyed that one.
Me too.
I liked it because it felt like the only one that was rooted in the book in terms of like it felt like a replacement for the Narrow House story, but completely departed from the book in a way that felt like it worked. So, like, the episode that takes place in Korea was not rooted in the book, but it did take a departure from the book, and it was amazing. But this one was like, okay, we need them to get a book like they did in The Narrow House, but we're just going to change it up and make it time travel. They go to 1921. Turns out that Tick was the guy. I felt that at the beginning of the episode when they time traveled. I was like, oh, he's the one.
He's Jackie Robinson.
We've seen enough time travel things. Oh. And I'm like, that's going to be important.
He had that dream at the very beginning of the very first episode of Jackie Robinson saving him from a monster. And I was like, why is this such an important moment for him? Because it's him.
Yeah.
It's him.
Yeah, I really like that, especially because I'm embarrassed to say, like, I'm one of the people that didn't really know about the Tulsa Massacre until Watchmen. Mm-hmm. And like, that is something deeply on me. And so it was interesting to
I mean, it's partly on you, but it's partly on
The American education system.
I was a very good student. I got an A in AP US history. It did not come up in AP US history.
Yeah, in US history,
I wish it did.
Did you know Abraham Lincoln solved racism? That's what happened.
But then the last racist shot him and he died.
Great.
The last racist, and it's done.
Yeah, it was so interesting because when I realized that, like, knowing that the Tulsa Massacre was going to be in the show, I was really interested to see, like, how could they do it, like, as, like, Watchmen did it so well, like, portrayed it in such a way that was so powerful. And I was really amazed by, like, using the tropes of this show and, like, the magic and the monsters and all of that. Like, they did something completely different that was really compelling. I loved Letitia and the grandmother in the fire. I don't know if... Tien, Jennifer, did you guys get to this part?
No, I'm
so
sorry.
So they go back in time to get the Book of Names. They go through the portal. Hippolyta helps them run the portal because she's like, you know, a computer now or something.
Her eyes go white and she can open portals.
Yeah,
that
she's like Storm, but what time? Yes, instead
it was very X-Men, especially because her hair changes color too. And so they go in to, and it's in Tulsa in 1921. And it's like the night of the massacre, and they go with. I'm really bad with character names. You'll find this as we go on. What is Tick's father's name?
Montrose.
And he was there. He was a survivor of the massacre. And so they have to go get the Book of Names. And Tick and his dad are fighting because he's been drinking and he wants to interfere. But there's also all this buildup of all the other issues that they've had. And so Letitia gets into the house, to the grandmother's house, and they know that like that house is going to burn up and they're all going to die. Their whole family's going to die. And so she's in there. And then meanwhile, Montrose sees his younger self with another little boy or not little boy. I guess they're like 14 or something. And young adolescent, but it's someone that he was romantic with, and you know, they're both closeted, and he like calls him the F word, and Montrose wants to, this other boy, and Montrose wants to interfere, and Tick is like, you can't interfere, like we can't mess with time, because otherwise I won't be here, you know, and all of that stuff. And then they realize that he's these men, these white people surround these kids, including Montrose, and kills the other boy. Oh. And then Montrose and his two other friends are like surrounded by all these white kids. And older Montrose explains like, oh, when there was a guy who came and like Jackie Robinson with his baseball bat and knocked them all out and saved us. And so they're waiting for that to happen. And then they realize that was Tick. And so then Tick goes.
It's a little Prisoner of Azkaban moment.
Yes.
God.
Yes. Very.
Oh my gosh.
A lot of Harry Potter. I will say. Oh, sorry. Whoa. We both will say.
Oh my gosh.
I think there's something about just a small thing that isn't a tiny little pet peeve, but like some of it feels a little too spelled out for me in some of these episodes. Like I feel like sometimes they say like 14 things they don't need to say. And one of it was like, I'm the baseball player. Like he hits the bat. He like almost walks into the bat and they look at each other. And then it should just be that Tick just goes over there. But he says, I'm the baseball player. Like, or he says like, I'm the guy. And it's like, guys, we're ahead of it. We know. Anyway, yeah, what will you say?
Show don't tell. Show don't tell.
What I was going to say is far less important and relevant, but Prisoner of Azkaban is the best of the Harry Potter movies. And I will fight people who disagree.
Absolutely.
I 100% agree.
Because Alfonso Cuarón has a visual language.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But also, I will agree with you, Melissa, in that it did feel throughout the show, not just in this episode, that there was a lack of trust in the audience sometimes, that we were there with them and that we were ready to understand and to see the moments.
But maybe a justifiable trust, because there were some moments I did not understand.
But that's the thing. They didn't do those moments that way. But then the ones where it's like, we get that he's the baseball player. You've been setting this up since the first episode. We good? They're like, no. Let's spend another 40 seconds making sure they fucking get it.
And I mean, I wonder if it too was like people being, the writers at some point being like, okay, wait a minute. Actually, there is a lot going on. So we should say everything that's going on just to make sure.
I think it is that balance, like you're saying, of like, I think if they pulled out, you know, let's say there were 1,000 ideas in the show, if they pulled out 300 of them, they probably could have trusted the audience a little bit more to not have to spell everything out. I think that's where the problem came in.
There was like a whole baptism in the last episode that I did not understand.
My
friends that I've been texting about the show with did not understand. But I really know that he was that baseball player in the Tulsa episode. There was an imbalance for sure.
I'm gonna go shed my skin suit and then I'll be back.
Why would you say that? I'm sorry. I think that this was a very ambitious show. It was a very entertaining show. And I think that I feel like Misha Green did a great job as a part of that team, as a part of that room. I think all of the writers deserve praise and for this undertaking, because it was, and they created something that really was truly an adaptation. They were like, this is a jumping off point for negotiation. And then they negotiated the shit out of new stories and interesting ways of looking at things. And they also acknowledged within the show, they were like, so this is the source material. We got a time machine. Different. It's different. It's not the same. This is like a thing that we're doing. And they like made a nod at it.
I will say, too, that like in less talented hands actor-wise, like this show would have not been as compelling. Those, that family of actors, like I was watching it earlier today and I was like, I love this family. Like, it just hit me. I was like, wait a minute. I love every single member of this family. And it's because those actors are so good.
They're so good.
Like, they're so good at grounding this wild story that is going every which way. But at the core of it, you're like, oh, this family and their relationships are so strong that it keeps you like looped into wanting to see all the crazy stuff that happens to them.
In the last minute.
Not to laugh. Because I'm thinking of Stacey Dash playing Letitia.
That I was explaining the ending very poorly, when Letitia has to run and she's saying this incantation in the language of Adam and is on her knees and is shouting it, and I'm like, Journey is putting in the work right here. She is like, this is tough to make feel in any way sane and grounded. I was very impressed by her in that moment.
Look, there were parts of it that I wish I had understood better, because sometimes I like went to the bathroom and came back and something wildly different was happening.
You know, you can pause it. It's on your click to your computer.
Normally you can have like a minute break, and on This Is Us they're gonna be talking about pretty much the same thing.
On This Is Us, Randall's gonna be anxious, Kevin's gonna be self-absorbed, and Zeke is gonna be kind of in the middle and kind of sad and feels responsible for their dad's death.
That's the whole episode. That's why you can go to the bathroom. But that was not true on this show. So there were parts of it that I do wish I had understood a little bit better. And maybe I should have been watching it more attentively than I was. Mm-hmm. And maybe that would have helped. But I never didn't enjoy watching the performances. Even if I came back and something insane was on the screen, it was always being perfectly acted. Everybody in it was great. They're always a joy to watch.
Yeah, like how you're such a good actor if you can do skin shed sex orgasm and make it work on screen. That is a level of acting that I have not seen. And I was like, okay, I this is grossing me out across the board, but like I buy these performances that you are doing that and having sex and your skin is falling off of you.
Yeah. Oh God, I can't. Mm-hmm. It's so gross. That's like my thing. I've said it before. It's my thing. The skin thing freaks me out.
The skin thing freaks everyone out.
I hated the skin thing. I hated
probably
it.
Probably my least favorite was the tarantula eyeball thing. Eyeballs just freak me out. Like anything that means you're getting jabbed in your eyes. So yeah, the tarantula's coming out of that woman's eyes, I did not enjoy.
My friend literally texted me after the first skin episode and he was like, have you seen this week's episode of Lovecraft Country? And I was like, yes. And he was like, I thought of you. You were probably in hell. And I was like, fuck you, man. That sucks.
Yeah, the skin.
I kind of got used to the skin. Is that weird to say?
Yeah.
That after like the fifth time, I was like,
I didn't.
Sex.
Yeah, Dana, actually, it is weird. It's weird.
What if I'm into it now? Yeah. That's the only way I want to have sex, with peeling skin.
We can mutiny and get rid of her, right? If she's into the skin thing, that's like a case.
If you had to do a spin-off podcast that's just about skin shedding, you're on your own.
You're on your own.
You know what?
We're not joining
Dana,
you.
Like Hippolyta, you should follow your heart and your big imagination and your big dreams.
I didn't like
it. I'm calling Mr. iHeartRadio, Mr. Isaac Heart Radio.
Isaac Heart Radio.
Isaac Heart Radio. Mr. Isaac Heart Radio. We got a skin freak here.
Something that I did like that I want to talk about really quickly in that last episode, sorry for people who didn't watch it, was when they were all in the car together and we have this nice moment of levity and they're singing along to that song, which did play in the first episode also. Fun fact, I did not recognize that on my own. They pointed that out in the Lovecraft Country podcast. I'm like, oh, shit, yeah.
No, claim that. Claim all those facts. No. Don't.
I'm going to be honest. I appreciate honesty. Like, I honestly think we should kick Dana out if she's into skin stuff.
I'm not in. Yeah. I just feel like it was so gross to me in like episode 5 that I was like almost couldn't watch. And then by the episode, maybe even the next episode, 6 or 7, when they're having sex voluntarily and her skin comes off, I was like, okay, well, at least like my eyes can watch the screen now.
No, I looked away. I was like, oh, skin shedding is coming. I gotta close my eyes.
Nope. But I think that is a good sort of segue into how we do get, as a society, inundated with racism, and we do become used to it. And like with
good transition,
wow, really good.
Thank you.
That was really a very smooth getting Star Baker.
Yeah, that's an American, not bad. But I think that it does sort of play into that where we did get, I mean, I was still horrified by it, but it was slightly easier than the first time I had seen it. And that's the thing. If you keep seeing a horrible, horrible, horrible thing over and over and over again, you have to some degree, inure yourself. Like, so that you're, did I use that word right? We'll see. Someone will tell me if I did
I was
or didn't
impressed.
At some point.
I thought it was a great
word. I don't even know what that word means,
that
just how impressed I am.
The word. But you have to in some way like brace yourself and be like, well, here's another one and here's another one. And I think that that's something that this show kind of does well, because the characters at a certain point are just like, this fucking magic shit again. Like, we're in episode 3, after all of the stuff that's happened with her house, she's like, get the fuck out of my house. And she's just kind of at that point, she's not like, oh, please have mercy. Like, she's just, get out of my house. This is my house. And they have to some degree, set aside their stuff. And I think that it becomes more horrific to them again when it affects D and when it sort of bleeds into the younger generation.
I wonder what the viewership of the show is, because
actually, I can tell you that because I have an IMDb Pro account.
Oh, well, because I was saying it's like so compelling, you know, and fascinating, and like the visuals are really interesting, but also it's like hard horror. Like, I think that will turn, and probably did turn, a lot of people off who were like, you know, it said like from the, you know, producer of Get Out, didn't it? I think on the ads.
I think so.
So like people who like liked Get Out, which wasn't like body gore horror, but like social horror, might have been like, ooh, and then
I mean,
came to this.
It was
and we're
a
like,
comedy.
Ah.
Get Out was listed as a comedy for the Golden Globes because they have facile separations of genre.
Well,
you have
but
to
who can forget
somehow.
The best comedy of the year, The Martian? I was rolling in the aisles.
I did not expect you to say that. That's
I forgot about The Martian also being a comedy.
Best comedy. Wow. My favorite jokes, some of the best jokes I've ever heard.
I don't know. I'm not going to claim to know the viewership, but I think it's popular or well liked enough that there was a whole SNL skit about it.
I saw that.
Sketch.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I just said skit. Oh no.
Oh no.
You're going to get canceled.
Wow. Cancel me.
You're a comedian.
Sketch comedians.
there was SNL a sketch about it?
Yeah. It was when
Issa Rae was hosting.
Issa Rae was hosting and they're at a football game and they're asking her, like, so what's this show you're watching? And the whole joke is that it's like so confusing that everyone, she's telling like the show about, they're like, wait, what is happening in this show? So
I missed that one.
Popular enough that it's like,
It's in the zeitgeist.
It's in the zeitgeist.
That's nice. Zeitgeisty, yeah. Good.
That reminds me of when I was 20. I was living in Ghana at the time. So I had gone home for summer break from college in the U.S. And I was working at a radio station. I did like an internship in production. And I was reading Lolita on my breaks, which was not as well known in Ghana. Oh. So people would ask me, they're like, oh, what's this book you're reading? And I'm like, it's Lolita. And then they would say, what's that book about?
Oh,
and I'm like,
no. It's about a father and his adopted daughter taking a road trip.
Yes, it's about a road trip. It's about a father-daughter road trip.
And it's interesting having to explain some things to people when you've become so normalized. So like, oh, yeah, you know that kid fucking book that people read that was turned into a couple of kid fucking films. Yeah.
We all agree it's literature, right?
Oh my God.
Yeah.
High and important literature.
Yeah. But yeah, that's funny. I didn't watch the Issa Rae episode of SNL because I'm bad, but I'll check that skit
I
out.
I really feel very embarrassed.
I watched Mike, a few of the skits.
Beep out the word
no,
skit.
No, because then Karama and I will just sound like we are saying skit without
no,
it making fun
out
of
the
you.
Word skit.
Wait, did you guys have you guys seen that clip of Studio 60?
Yes, it's
around?
One of my favorite clips. Mm-hmm. I was going to bring it up. Yes,
where the
great.
Dad, so Studio 60 is like the SNL, it's like the Aaron Sorkin SNL. And, you know, one of the writers is showing his parents around and the dad calls it a skit. And
no, it's his mom. It's his mother.
His mom calls it a skit.
And she's complimenting him. She says, oh, this is like where you do all your wonderful skits. She's just a nice lady.
And he goes, it's not a skit, mom. Skits are what the football players do when they dress up as cheerleaders and mistake it for wit. What we do here is sketches, and it's some of the most groundbreaking comedic mind in the country doing things seen by millions of people. And then out of nowhere, the dad goes, well, that's all very well, son, but your brother is out in Afghanistan.
Sorkin's done it again.
Aaron, oh, my God. The most Aaron Sorkin thing that's ever been. And
I'm going to find that clip.
It goes right from 1 to 100 in 30 seconds.
I'm gonna find this clip because everyone needs to watch it.
His mother is never going to tour her son's workplace ever again.
On that note, last thoughts on the show?
Very ambitious. And my final word is incredibly ambitious. A really big universe that did really fascinating things that I think details will keep trickling down to me that I took out of it.
Yeah, you'll just wake up in the middle of the night. You'll be like,
I'll be like, that was a weird, cool visual.
Yeah.
I would totally recommend it 100% to watch because I think so much of what it does is the amount of good that the show is doing outweighs the nitpicky bad, not nitpicky, we're not being nitpicky, but the bad things that we've mentioned. I fully enjoyed it, and also just those actors are so talented. Just incredible. So yeah, love it.
Yeah. I think there are so many wonderful individual moments from this show that I think will end up thinking about long in the future. And it's such an accomplishment to be able to craft a show that has really, really iconic moments like that.
Would you say it was crafted with love?
Hey! Okay, see yourself out, Melissa.
Okay, that's my time. I was a little more mixed on it, I think, as a whole. I love the episodes that I loved and the scenes that I loved, I thought were truly incredible and just some of the highest level television. And then some parts I thought were just not good at all. So I feel like a little... I've never felt this way about a show. Does that make sense? that we're so, such swings of highs and lows... that I feel like sometimes I feel about a show of a first season isn't great. And then the sixth season is great, but this I all felt in one season. Mm. So I feel mixed, but I'm happy it exists.
Did you watch the fourth season of Veronica Mars?
Melissa? Yes, I did. Yes, I did.
A similar feeling?
Mm-hmm. We'll have to talk about that maybe in a bonus episode.
Off the air, we'll have another. Because I remember you were a marshmallow. You had talked about Veronica's seven jeans. But what I thought about the show, a lot of things. But one, I think that it did a really good job trying to take a structure that I think is difficult to translate onto a screen. Because we talked a lot about how we enjoyed the book in terms of individual mini stories. But I think that's very difficult to do separate bottle episodes that are all connected to each other. And especially if it's something that's being released weekly, because you also need to think about how you're going to bring people back in next week. And I think that if they're all separate stories that sort of involve the same people, but you're not quite sure how they're all connected, then it's going to be a little bit harder to bring people back week to week.
Yeah, you need so a cliffhanger at the end to drive the plot forward.
Yeah, so for me, I think that's it was a good option for them to restructure it. I thought that some of the changes and some of the inclusions that they made didn't quite make sense for me fully. Still, I felt less weird about Montrose being gay in this by the end, but still didn't fully get it because it felt like it was trying to say that a cycle of abuse is like kind of okay because his family abused him, so it's okay that he abused his kid, and that didn't sit well with me. And then again, the Two-Spirit character that was killed, that did not land the way that they intended it to land for anyone, I think. But I think that overall, really great ideas, and I also would recommend it.
Quick question. George being Atticus's father, not in the book, right?
No.
Okay.
You asked that last time.
I just kept forgetting, because that was one of the things where I was watching, and I was like, okay.
But also Montrose wasn't like in a majority sexless marriage with his
all
wife
very,
because he wasn't gay.
All very different.
Or at least they did not make mention of it being a majority sexless marriage in the book.
I don't think that I don't think they did. I don't think they really talked about sex in the book, which is
Not really.
No, and Atticus and Letitia didn't have a relationship, a sexual relationship.
Which I loved in the book. I liked her having a dream and a goal that had nothing to do with romance. I thought that was really nice, but
Hollywood, baby.
Make the hot people kiss. I'm an action figure person when it comes to TV shows. I like when hot people kiss.
Well, I also feel like I mean, I used to be very on Tumblr, and there were a lot of like ace people on Tumblr who were like, we just want TV where people aren't trying to have sex. Like, that would be super cool if there was just a TV show where it didn't need to be sexy people being sexy with each other sexing. Like, it's fine if they're sexy, but maybe they could just be friends, which it stinks that, not stinks, because I think that they do have incredible chemistry, Jonathan Majors and Journey Smollett, but I think that it would have been great to just see these two friends who care about each other a lot because they both grew up reading sci-fi together, just have this connection. But I think that there was a big emphasis on family, particularly toward the end of this. And Gia became like sort of part of their family near the end. I got mad about that, though, because I was like, girl, have some self-respect. This guy said that you meant nothing to him.
Yeah,
then you stayed not only in his country, but in his city, just chilling.
Waiting to save his fucking family.
She is a bisexual, though, so maybe they just had, like, they have different levels of, you know, jealousy and self-respect, you know, as fox demons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we don't want to speak for the fox demon community.
Jennifer?
I'll speak for the fox human community. I think it would have been okay if she killed him. He murdered her best friend in cold blood. He stood there and shot a bunch of nurses in front of her. You're really telling me that out of 99 other men, nobody else would take her to the movies?
Yes. Because they were movies are weird. You're weird.
All right. I think if you went through 99 other men, there was probably somebody who was a comparable level of goodness to the person who killed your best friend.
Yes. You have to believe that something in Tick is even after killing her best friend, makes him still worth, like, not murdering. When you're like, wow, those 99 other men must real have been bad. Real pieces real of shit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What you forgot, yeah. Jen, is that liking Judy Garland movies is gay. So.
Jen, maybe she also had 99 other best friends, and they each one
oh my
killed
God, and they're all
the best friend. And but then they all didn't take them to the movies additionally, you know? Like, so this is, like, one better. It's like what it's like when your standards are so low, they're like at the floor because people are shitty on Tinder. And then it's like, well, this one actually asked me out on a date.
That's the lesson. Uh-huh.
Been there.
Yeah. Low bar.
Low bar. Low bar.
Well, on that note,
everybody can raise their standards. Just to say that. That's okay to do.
Oh, but to finish my point, there was an emphasis on family. And I think that having Letitia and Tick make a family mm-hmm. was something that played into that. Mm-hmm. So I get why, like, story-wise they did it, but also it would have been great if they had not. And my favorite character, the little boy at the library reading Dream to the Center of the Earth, never came back.
No.
I hope he's happy doing great. And living his best life.
He's doing great. He maybe probably wrote a bestseller, and I heard it sold for six figures.
He's like a 70-year-old man now in, like, 20 years. So I hope that he's, like, doing fun things life. In quarantine with his grandkids.
Probably.
Well, on that note, that's it for Lovecraft Country. Next week, we are diving into our new book, which is V for Vendetta, like the omnibus, is in three books, book one, book two, book three. So we'll only talk book one, which I feel like is a reasonable. There's plenty to talk about there. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then we'll chat about the movie. It is scarily prescient. Prescient? What do you say?
I say prescient. Is that correct?
Yes. Scarily.
I just write that word down.
Frighteningly P-word. So
you
see
sound
you then.
Like, you sound like Ben Shapiro. Oh.
Wet ass present. That's our show for the week. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Dana Schwartz, and you can find me on Twitter at Dana Schwartz with 3 Z's. You can follow Jennifer Wright at Jen Ashley Wright. Karama Danqua is at Karama Drama. Melissa Hunter is at Melissa FTW. And Tian Tran is smart enough to have gotten off Twitter, but she is on Insta at Hank Tina. Our executive producer is Christopher Hesiodis, and we're produced and edited by Mike Johns. Special thanks to David Wasserman. Next week, we'll get into the reason the internet knows who Guy Fawkes is. It's V for Vendetta, just a little bit late for the 5th of November. Popcorn Book Club is a production of iHeartRadio.